from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and this is Odyssey. Newsflash, the United States is considering some sort of military attack on Iran. Surprised? Not likely. Details of war plans have been all over the news lately. The White House has certainly made no secret of its desire to see Saddam Hussein ousted. But is that all that's behind the very public discussion of war? Coming up on Odyssey, what's unfolding in the ongoing public conversation about war with Iraq? That's Odyssey, right after this. From Chicago Public Radio, this is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. There's been some squawking about the fact that major newspapers in this country are publishing reports that include leaked information about military plans for an attack against Iraq. Now, the concern with secrecy is a little paradoxical. After all, the Bush administration has made it perfectly clear to any and all who will listen that it seeks what it euphemistically calls regime change in Iraq. And moreover, the president is clearly willing to use military force to get it. That signal has been sent loud and clear. But the rest of the public and media discussion about Iraq is a little harder to decode. Are we having a public debate about whether to go to war? Is the discussion merely a way of informing the public about what to expect from an inevitable conflict? Who is talking to whom here, and what are they saying? Today on Odyssey, we're going to pick through what is and is not being communicated in the current public discussion of war with Iraq. Here to talk with us today is political scientist Kurt Gaubatz. He joins us from Norfolk, Virginia. Joining us from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is historian Bruce Cummings. And here in Chicago, political scientist John Mearsheimer. John, let me ask you to start us off here. These leaked reports about military plans, obviously someone was giving out that information. Why?
Well, I think there are two big fights inside the Pentagon or inside the Bush administration now that are taking place that motivated the leaker, whoever he or she is. The first fight has to do with whether or not we should attack Iraq. The fact of the matter is there are large numbers of people inside the administration, especially inside the American military, who are opposed to attacking Iraq. So that's one fight. The other fight is among those who believe we should attack Iraq, but are debating how best to do it. Now, if you're opposed to attacking Iraq, leaking the plan makes good sense because it shows the American people what a massive operation it's going to be and how much potential there is for things to go wrong. So it is possible that somebody who was opposed to the operation leaked it. Furthermore, if you are in favor of using a plan that relies heavily on American air power and places little emphasis on ground forces, you would have an interest in leaking the plan because this plan shows that we're going to use large-scale ground forces, about 250,000 troops, to do the job. So those opposed to the present emphasis on heavy forces and lots of heavy forces have an incentive to leak it as well. So I think what's going on here is that in the context of the fights that are taking place inside the Pentagon, people are trying to use the public medium to help win the day in those battles.
Bruce Cummings, does that amount to a public debate about whether to go to war or not?
Well, I agree with John about why people may leak things from the government. I would just add that often it's difficult to know exactly what the motive of the leaker may be. Sometimes it's simply to squash a plan that an enemy inside the administration has. But it also can be an attempt to get a debate going. Two of the major leaks were first page right column stories in the New York Times, and they did stimulate some debate. When you talk to people in the State Department over the years, they're often amazed that there isn't more debate about something as important as going to war with Iraq. And frankly, I don't think there has been much of a debate so far. In our paper of record, the New York Times, and especially because of its concerns with the Middle East, you've had some debate. But on the media, mainstream media, not read by intellectuals who read the New York Review of Books and things like that. And on TV, you have a debate that is very constrained, essentially, by the partisan politics of Washington. You have a liberal who somehow identified with the Democratic Party, a conservative party, a conservative representing the Republican Party, and they basically shout at each other. Another aspect of this debate that, I mean, in other words, the leaks do have a very good function in stimulating debate, but another element that's almost completely absent is the Iraqi side of this. As far as I can tell, there's been very little good investigative reporting from the Iraqi side. The country is accessible to Western reporters, but there's been very little. And especially, almost no discussion of what Iraq might do in the event of an invasion. Instead, you get a summary paragraph saying Iraq has chemical, biological, and wants nuclear weapons, and God knows what they're going to do. I think Iraq probably has very specific plans, say, to set off bombs in Riyadh or to generally extend the war in the Middle East and cause a conflagration quite beyond anything that we saw in 1990 and 91. I don't know that, but I'd certainly like to see experts weigh in on what we can actually expect on the ground from Iraq, as opposed to something like blowing off anthrax bombs, which would have the inevitable result of the United States simply destroying Baghdad and the regime.
So, Bruce, let me summarize you and tell me if I'm getting this right. The leaks have had the potentially good effect of stimulating debate about whether war is a good idea, a debate that you didn't think we were having before that, but still the substance of debate is somewhat limited. The terms of a possible war and its consequences is somewhat limited, and we're not getting into the details well enough.
Absolutely. I mean, John Mearsheimer is exactly right that the military is very wary of going into another war with Iraq. After all, we won the last one in terms of expelling him from Kuwait, but we did not win it in terms of eliminating the problem, and thus we set up another containment system like we have in Korea, various other places around the world, for wars that in effect are not do not come to the conclusion people expected at the beginning. Afghanistan is like that too, where we have knocked over the Taliban, but we haven't gotten any of the major leaders of either the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. And we have another containment front in Central Asia. And the military is the agency, the army in particular, that has to maintain these containment, far-flung containment fronts. Really, from World War II down to the present, we don't have a very good record at actually winning decisively the wars that we enter. So I think the American military, I would say a debate is raging within the Pentagon and within the Bush administration that is much wider than the public debate. The public debate is deeply constrained by September 11th because people somehow think it's unpatriotic to pipe up and state their views on an issue of grave national concern. And instead, we get a lot of patriotic hoopla and very little debate.
I want to come back to that, just the shape of the debate a little bit. But first, Kurt Taylor-Gaubatz, let me ask you to weigh in here. What do you think? We've been talking, using the term public debate and public discussion sort of loosely without being too specific about who we mean by the public here. What do you see going on in terms of messages aimed at, quote-unquote, the American public? What's anybody trying to tell the public?
Well, I think I agree completely with Bruce that the public discussion so far has been very limited, and I don't think the public is actually overly engaged by this issue yet. I think it's still an elite discussion. And I think that, in fact, really, I want to push Bruce's point a little further. We really need to expand this discussion in several ways. That in some ways, the military discussion, while very important and a critical component of this, is in some ways less interesting and consequential than the really important questions that I think are starting to emerge in the last few weeks about what are really the long-term effects of this kind of a strategy. And there I think the debate has to be opened even further to think about the economic effects in the longer run. Is what's going to happen to the price of oil, what's going to happen to who's going to pay for this conflict, which is likely to be more expensive than the last one in the hearings yesterday, who's going to pay for occupying Iraq if that's necessary. And so I think it is actually critical that we have this public debate. I think it's how we make decisions in a democracy. And my hope is that it will actually be expanded beyond the narrow elements of the military planning, which is the important first part of it, but doesn't go far enough.
Well, when you say public debate, who do you mean? I mean, I think that a lot of people wouldn't be particularly interested in little relatively small details of how things are going to be carried out or what range of responses might be available to Saddam Hussein, I could see a lot of people not being too concerned about that. So when you say that there needs to be greater public debate, who needs to be included? Kurt Taylor Gauwitz.
Well, I think the debate happens at several different levels. Of course, there's the kind of elite debate that happens particularly within the Beltway, and the kind of debate that happens in the Pentagon is one that is not going to be that interesting to a lot of people about what kinds of forces should you use and what's the best way to apply military force in this particular situation. But all the levels of the debate are important. There's a policymakers debate, there's a debate amongst policy elites, opinion leaders who give more thought to these questions, bringing in academics, people who think about the region and think about Iraq, think about the problems of reconstructing destroyed countries, things like that. And then there's the level of the broad public support. And going to war in a democracy is something that requires a significant degree of public support. And the average person is probably not that interested in the minutiae of who really opposes Saddam Hussein and do we have effective allies there. But they do want to hear, I think, elites talking about, is this a viable project? What is it going to be the effect on the economy? What is going to be the effect on casualties in the military? What is going to be the effect on the war on terrorism? And those kinds of discussions filter down from this elite level discussion and I think are quite critical to what we want to call the broadest public discussion.
Today on the program, we're talking about the broadest public discussion, or the public discussion such as it is so far, about going to war in Iraq. John Mearsheimer, what are your responses to what you've heard so far?
Well, I agree with
from our panelists
pretty
today.
Much everything that my two colleagues have said. I wanted to add another dimension to this. I think that the proponents of attacking Iraq have done a brilliant job up to now in creating the impression that this is a done deal, that we are going to attack Iraq, and it's only a question of when and how. And what they have tried to do is preclude a debate on the subject. And it could be that someone leaked these documents to get that debate going, as Bruce alluded to before. But when you look inside the administration at the constellation of forces, what's quite amazing is how much resistance there is to this idea of attacking Iraq. The American military is deeply opposed to the idea. The State Department is opposed, and Colin Powell, who is the head of the State Department and is a former military officer, has no appetite for this operation. The CIA is opposed. It appears that the principal proponents of attacking Iraq are a handful of civilians, very hawkish civilians in the Pentagon, and a handful of hawkish civilians around the Vice President, Dick Cheney. And those folks and their allies in the media, people like William Safire and Charles Krauthammer, have done an absolutely brilliant job of conveying to the American people that Saddam Hussein is of such a magnitude of threat that we simply have to attack him. That decision has been made, and now it's only a question of when. But slowly but steadily, what's happening here is all sorts of people who have reservations about this operation, the whole idea of even doing it, are beginning to sort of voice their opinions. And I think slowly but steadily, what you're going to see happen is more and more resistance to the operation itself.
So the hawks, in a sense, got out ahead of everybody else and set up a perception that this is a done deal, and to the extent that there needed to be a debate, it's done, we've decided, we're going ahead.
For sure, and they did that in the wake of 9/11, when a certain amount of momentum was easy to build and sustain. But it's going to be much more difficult.
I agree with that, and I think there's another element, too. Before 9/11, I think external observers of the Bush administration had some difficulty knowing whether Rumsfeld and Cheney, as so-called hawks, and Colin Powell in charge of the State Department, you know, how they would work together. And my own judgment was that Powell would actually be able to best these guys in internal wrangling. That has been so far dead wrong. And I think part of the reason is 9/11, but part of the reason is also the war in Afghanistan. The war in Afghanistan has not gone so well. You have the Taliban underground, and Al-Qaeda still functioning, and Osama bin Laden, you know, who knows where he is.
Bruce Cummings, we've got to take a break. So let me ask you to hold that thought, because I want to come back and talk about the factors, these external factors to Iraq that are structuring the way this conversation is going on. More to come here on Odyssey as we talk about the public conversation around war in Iraq. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Support for this WBEZ program is provided by the University of Chicago's Master of Liberal Arts program. It's the next great thing to do with your life. Information is available at an open house and lecture Saturday, August 3rd at the Gleacher Center, 450 North City Front Plaza, or at 773-702-1726, extension 2. We can see it there on the kitchen counter. Lonely little thing. It's your Chicago Public Radio renewal envelope. Maybe you just haven't had a free moment to buy those new 37-cent stamps. We need your membership renewal in order to keep bringing you the news you depend on each day. Drop that renewal in the mail today. You'll feel great when you do. Thanks. You're listening to WBEZ Chicago 91.5 FM, Chicago Public Radio. You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Today on the program, we are decoding a little bit the public conversation that's taking place about a possible war with Iraq. We're joined for the conversation from Norfolk, Virginia, by Kurt Taylor Gaubatz. He's the director of the Graduate Program in International Studies at Old Dominion University and the author of Elections and War. Here in Chicago, we're talking with John Mearsheimer, professor of political science and co-director of the program on international security policy at the University of Chicago. John Mearsheimer's latest book is called The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. From Ann Arbor, Michigan, we're talking with historian Bruce Cummings. He's the author of War and Television. Bruce Cummings, let's go back to the point you were making just before the break, the way in which the events of September 11th and the war in Afghanistan are shaping what we can say about war with Iraq.
Yeah, I think the war in Afghanistan did not come to a decisive conclusion, and what's happened is that the United States now has a new strategic area in Central Asia with a number of new military bases that have to be maintained, and above all, a government in Afghanistan that has to be maintained, even with President Karzai having personal American bodyguards. We're engaged in a nation-building effort there, which is exactly what President Bush said he didn't want to do when he came into office. And I think in the light of September 11th and the moot outcome of the war in Afghanistan, a decisive victory in Iraq is very much valued in a way that it wasn't before. It's also true that President Bush's father was responsible for the mooted outcome of the Gulf War, in which Saddam Hussein was allowed to stay in power. Cheney and Powell were also in that administration. And so there's a tendency, a very strong one among those people, with Powell accepted, to want to somehow get back in it and make this a decisive victory. I would suggest, though, that there are many issues that Americans ought to be concerned with here. Some of them have been mentioned already. Certainly Kurt is right about the enormous cost of nation building in Iraq after Saddam Hussein is gone. But we also need to think of the enormous costs of overextension. We've already inherited, as I just said, a new strategic front in Central Asia. We have on the books, presumably, a plan to invade and topple the government of Iraq and maybe occupy it for a long time with some sort of military government. Then we'll get involved in containing what is the major regional threat in the Middle East, and that's Iran. We'd be bumped up against their borders. So I don't see that those are just a few of the consequences of invading Iraq and toppling Saddam Hussein, and those things need to be debated. And I also don't see why we can't say, with a decade of hindsight, that what is not broke doesn't need fixing. I mean, Saddam Hussein is not threatening anybody. He's under a regime of pressure that makes it very difficult for him to field the kind of army he had in 1990. so on and so forth, and therefore leaving well enough alone and continuing the containment of Saddam Hussein strikes me as a much wiser policy.
Kurt Taylor-Gobetz, let me ask you to comment on some of the points that Bruce Cummings raised. The idea that a swift victory, or decisive victory at least, is politically important in Iraq. I wonder from the public point of view, to what extent you think people see the way in which Iraq is basically two pieces of unfinished business. It's unfinished from 1991, and then this unfinished business of the war in Afghanistan. How important do you think that particular story of Iraq is to the question of public support?
I don't think the public is particularly concerned about the legacy effects, about whether this is a continuation of the other things. I think the public is going to be concerned about what is, and this is the issue that Bruce raised at the very end, is what are the consequences of not taking action, and can we balance and weigh the costs of action against inaction? And the pro-war hawks, as John pointed out, have done a very good job of worrying people that here is a person who seems unstable in many dimensions, who is pursuing, if not recreation of the greater Babylonian empire of the past, at least weapons of mass destruction, who seems angry with the world as we know it, and that's something to make us understandably concerned. The question then becomes, what's the best way to deal with it? And that, I think, is the discussion that, I mean, I think that's the kind of discussion that the public is actually looking to hear from the experts. I'm looking to hear what I don't know. I don't know about Iraq. I don't know who the real forces in there are. Sometimes I start to think that no one does from the discussion we're getting so far. But I think that's the discussion that the public wants to and needs to hear. Decisive victory, I think, is not only not important, it's impossible. I don't think anyone who takes part in a debate seriously believes that there's going to be a decisive victory in the sense that, and here Bruce's language shifts a little bit between the military operation, I think, it could look very much like Afghanistan within a relatively short amount of time, shorter than many people predicted. The military situation was at least under control. The problem is what comes after, and what comes after is in Iraq likely to look a lot like what comes after in Afghanistan, a situation where you have no functioning political institutions that you can build on, and you have to decide whether or not you're willing to make the extraordinary commitment. Today they were saying $16 billion for the first year alone of trying to rebuild that country and deal with the new realities of strategic politics in that region.
John Mearsheimer?
I'd like to make two additional points that point up why Bush has an incentive to at least talk about, if not do, Iraq. One is that the economy is in really serious trouble, and I think this is going to threaten Bush's standing in the country and the electoral prospects for the Republicans this fall and in the next presidential election. It's also quite clear that he gets very high marks for his handling of foreign policy in general and the war on terrorism in particular. So by keeping foreign policy issues and military issues and war-related issues in the headlines, he enhances his standings and he takes people's minds off of the economic woes that we have these days. So I think there's that.
Well, and he also thereby silences some debate because opponents aren't as willing to speak out against the president on those issues as they are in the economy.
Sure. You remember when Tom Daschle began to question the military policy of the president in terms of the war on terrorism earlier this year, and they began to question his patriotism. It's a very effective weapon, and that'll certainly be true if we begin to ramp up an attack against Iraq. Another point that bears mentioning is that the hawks in the administration believe that the Arab-Israeli conflict, or the conflict involving the Palestinians and the Israelis, is inextricably linked to an attack on Iraq. And they believe, this is the hawks, that if we attack Iraq and we knock Saddam out of power and we install a friendly regime in Iraq, we will in effect silence the Palestinians and be in a position where we can work with the Israelis hand in hand to shut down the Arab-Israeli conflict. In other words, hawks think that what is needed here is for the American military to show how much might it has and how much presence it has around the globe. And as the Wall Street Journal, which is a big advocate of attacking Iraq, says, the road to peace in Palestine runs through Baghdad. So if you believe that, like Bush probably does, that too creates an incentive to go after Baghdad sooner rather than later.
John Mearsheimer is a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. His latest book is called The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. We're talking today about the public discussion that's going on about whether or not, and whether, when, and how to go to war with Iraq, and what sorts of messages are actually circulating in all of the talk. We'll take some phone calls a bit later in the program. If you'd like to join in with a question or a comment, give us a call. Our number is 1-888-859-1800. That's 1-888-859-1800. We're also talking today with Bruce Cummings, who is a historian at the University of Chicago and the author of War and Television. He joins us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. And from Norfolk, Virginia, we are joined by Kurt Taylor Galbatz, who is the director of the graduate program in international studies at Old Dominion University and the author of Elections and War. Let me turn, if I can, ask you to turn your attention to another issue.
Gretchen, could I come back for just a minute? Since
sure.
You mentioned elections and war, and John brought up elections.
Sure.
I think we should be, I'm going to disagree a little bit with John here about the way the electoral dynamic, public support dynamic plays for this. The international conference is great for Bush, and taking attention off the economy is certainly something that he benefits from. But I think that all the way going to war with Iraq and then dealing with the problems of cleaning up Iraq at the height of an electoral season is probably not a very attractive electoral strategy for the incumbent. So I think that we I don't think that I think there's certainly an incentive to keep things bubbling along in a kind of crass political sense. But the incentive to actually go to war, I think, is somewhat reduced by that factor.
That assumes
the other factor, I think. No, sorry,
I was just going to say, Kurt, that assumes that they agree with your assessment, which I agree with, that cleaning up after you attack Iraq will be a real mess and very costly, both politically, militarily, and economically.
Yes,
they probably don't
always
agree with that.
It always shocks me to discover that some people disagree with me, but there you have it. The other factor I think also needs to be out on the table here that we need to be sure have, and it surprisingly hasn't come up yet, is the external effects of all this discussion, both on Iraq, but also on Europe. And it's surprising we haven't discussed Europe yet, where I think support for an attack on Iraq is very low and is extremely problematic. That and the Bush administration, while not overly inclined to take into consideration the attitude of the Europeans, I think is ultimately going to have to confront this. And they've continually said that it requires some kind of international agreement, though they haven't defined what that really means.
Well, expand on that. What do you think the effects so far have been on Europe of all the discussion?
Well, I think that they're so far not buying into it, that the hawks have not been successful yet in convincing the Europeans that this is a problem that requires an immediate and severe military solution. Now, whether that will come along, I suspect depends more on the back-channel diplomacy than the public diplomacy. Though Europeans are worried that the European public is very skeptical of Bush in general and the Iraq policy in particular.
Bruce Cummings, let me ask you to take up another subject, which has come up occasionally in a few editorials and op-ed pieces, which has to do with the discussion about who gets to decide that we're going to war. Inevitably, whenever anybody talks about military action, the point is raised that the Constitution says that Congress has to declare war. And in this context, that's been raised a couple of times, as well as other legal issues around whether the United States is legally justified in going to war and by what standard, under what rules. What do you make of all that talk about process?
Well, I think it follows on very much the point that Kurt was just making. It isn't only a question of our allies not supporting us in going to war with Iraq. Even Tony Blair has been caviling about it, and he's been Bush's poodle ever since September 11th. In Europe, there's very severe criticism of what would be unilateralism on steroids if the United States went in by itself to attack Iraq. But on the other hand, it's very unlikely that Europeans are going to supply any troops. It's also unlikely that our allies are going to pay for it, as they did in 1990-91, $60 billion war effort, and allies, especially Japan, paid more than two-thirds of it. The Europeans raise questions of international law. What right do we have to launch a preemptive attack against Iraq on the supposition that sometime in the future Iraq may have weapons of mass destruction? Secondly, you raised, of course, the issue of American domestic politics. We haven't had a war since 1941, when a president went to Congress and asked for a declaration of war. The last one was on December 8th, 1941. In Korea, the Truman administration chose a different legislature, the United Nations, where it knew it could dominate the proceedings rather than bringing the issue of the Korean War to Congress. Lyndon Johnson got the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, which we now know was based on essentially a fabricated incident. And the Gulf War was fought without a congressional declaration of war. This time, I think it's even worse, in that the Democratic Party, which is presumably the loyal opposition, has been next to worthless on foreign policy in terms of providing an effective critique and parameters of debate on the Bush foreign policy. It's true that Daschle tried that once and got beaten back, as John said, his patriotic credentials were questioned. John Kerry, at a meeting of Democrats last week, launched the biggest critique of the Bush administration, one that I quite agreed with, but it's notable for its rarity. So you have now in the Senate some hearings going on discussing a war in Iraq, where you have people like Caspar Weinberger, who may be a former defense secretary, but he's beyond his best years and functions like a wind-up doll on the question of Iraq. He's been in favor of knocking it over for a long time, and according to his testimony yesterday, doesn't care much about what the consequences will be after that. Mort Halperin, I think, offered some very good testimony in those hearings. But the point is, that's a very sad substitute for a national debate. And I'd like to see the debate come around to why one administration after another launches big wars that it doesn't win, Korea, Vietnam, and now perhaps Iraq, and does that essentially with some sort of acclamation vote in Congress or nor consultation whatsoever.
John Mearsheimer, I wonder if there isn't a sort of double whammy going on where that is concerned, because you've got a situation where the trend in the last 40 years or whatever has been for the president to decide we'll go to war, we'll undertake military action, and then Congress is sort of has this burden of having to prove that he's wrong if they're going to not support him or have their patriotism questioned. And then in this particular narrower context, you've got September 11th, which makes anybody who questions the president's conduct of foreign policy doubly suspect. So you've got this debate that's sort of skewed against raising opposition to the war in two ways.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It's very difficult in recent times to get the country up for a debate and an actual vote on declaring war against a particular adversary. We didn't do it in the Gulf War. We didn't do it against Kosovo. Or against Yugoslavia in 1999, and I don't think it's going to happen here. I think there will be a resolution, not a binding resolution, but there'll be a vote in Congress if this one goes far enough down the road. It's hard for me to imagine at this point in time that Bush will go to war without some sort of vote of approval from Congress. But I want to disagree with Bruce on one point. I think, Bruce, that with regard to Korea and with regard to Vietnam, Korea was seen as a stalemate by and large, and Vietnam was definitely a loss. But I think since then, the three wars that we have fought, the Gulf War in 1991, the war against Yugoslavia in 1999, and the war against Afghanistan in 2001, those conflicts are all seen as stunning American military victories. One can talk about the political problems that resulted afterwards, but we accomplished our goal against Saddam, which was to throw him out of Kuwait in 1991. We got Milosevic to effectively capitulate in 1999. And the war in Afghanistan, even though we haven't gotten the leaders of the Taliban, as you say, and we haven't gotten the leaders of Al-Qaeda, as you say, is generally seen as a stunning military success. And I think as a result of those three victories in the 1990s, it's very difficult for people to argue that the American military can't do the job and win a stunning victory in Iraq.
People regardless of whether that might be correct or incorrect. You
yes,
just can't say
yes.
it.
Yes, I'm just saying that the precedents look very promising when you think about this operation.
We need to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and take some phone calls at 1-888-859-1800. We're talking today about the public conversation about war in Iraq. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio.
This is WBEZ Chicago. This is a test of the emergency alert system. This concludes this test of the emergency alert system. This is WBEZ Chicago. Support for this WBEZ program is provided by Chicago's Department of Cultural Affairs, presenting Earth from Above, an exhibition of photographs of our planet by Jan Artus Bertrand in Millennium Park, June 21st through September 15th, open daily. Further information online at earthfromabovechicago, that's all one word, .org.
Welcome back to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Our conversation today is about the discussion of war in Iraq and what is going on in all of this public talk about Iraq. Is it actually a public debate? Is it something else? Is it an administration internal squabble? Who knows? We're trying to figure it out. Our guests are John Mearsheimer, a political scientist at the University of Chicago and the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy there. His latest book is called The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. We're joined from Ann Arbor, Michigan by Bruce Cummings, who is a historian here in Chicago, and he's the author of War and Television. From Norfolk, Virginia, Kurt Taylor Gaubatz is joining us. He's the author of Elections and War, and he directs the graduate program in international studies at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. Our number again is 1-888-859-1800. Let's talk with Chet. Hi, Chet. You're on Odyssey.
Hi, Gretchen. I'm certainly not a world strategist, but it puzzles me that the discussion of this situation is very bipolar. It's either we do go to war, take over the whole country, throw him out, or we don't go to war. I'm just wondering if there isn't possibly a middle course. It seems to me that the problem with Saddam Hussein is that even though we've defanged him, he still has power because he has a flow of cash from illicit petroleum sales and all the smuggling that goes on across the borders. Now, since we already control the skies over the northern and southern thirds of the country, wouldn't it be easier and make more sense just to grab off a few hundred or a few thousand square miles of strategic territory where we could ensure the security of the Marsh Arabs in the south and the Kurds in the north, curtail most of the smuggling that keeps him afloat, and would also provide us with basing so we wouldn't have to ask permission from neighboring countries to conduct our operations. I'm just wondering if anybody's analyzed the situation from this sort of minimalist, less ambitious point of view.
Chet's not a strategist full-time, just in his spare time. John Mearsheimer, what do you think of that?
Well, I think there, in general, I think if there were a middle ground, people would have gravitated to it. Lots of people would have gravitated to it because lots of people who are opposed to this operation do want to do something about Saddam Hussein, and they're just searching for an alternative, but it just doesn't appear to be there. And I think there are all sorts of problems with what you propose. The fact of the matter is that even if you grab some real estate in Iraq and you station forces there,
Saddam Hussein, in the scenario that you painted, would still be in power. He would still have access to some amounts of money, and he would still be able to pursue weapons of mass destruction. You want to understand that the really important issue here is not Saddam Hussein sponsoring terrorism. Much is made of that, but that's not the issue. Nobody's been able to make any reasonable connection between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. The real problem is that he is in the process of trying to acquire nuclear weapons, and we don't want him to have nuclear weapons. In fact, we don't want him to have any kind of weapons of mass destruction. And to prevent that from happening, you have to go in and take him out, and you have to run the country and install a regime that will do your bidding for you over the years. And that is a very difficult task.
Bruce Cummings, let me ask you to comment on this, though, because you were talking at the very beginning of our conversation about the lack of subtlety or nuance in laying out the possible scenarios. Is there more middle ground here, either good or bad, that we ought to know about?
Well, I think the caller, Chet, laid out very well what has been the middle ground. It started after 1991. Our containment of Saddam Hussein started essentially as he laid it out, a no-fly zone in the north and a sharp constriction of Iraq's ability to export oil. That proved to be such a hardship for the Iraqi people, with untold numbers of children dying and so on, that under UN pressure and multilateral pressure, the sanctions were loosened, so that Saddam Hussein is making a lot of money on his oil these days, but also the situation of the population has improved. I just think that backs up John's point that you have to go in and overthrow Saddam Hussein. To allow him to stay in power in Baghdad in any form means that whatever hardships we impose on Iraq will be imposed on the Iraqi population itself. I also would like to come back to the question of, do we win the wars that we fight? I think John is exactly right that our military prowess in terms of smart weapons, being able to hit targets that we want, get rid of military forces that we want to get rid of, I think it's astounding, and it's the wonder of the world. John is right about the Gulf War in 1991, particularly the ground war, and I remember him predicting that it would be over very quickly in a teach-in that we had at Chicago back then. But I think John knows better than I do that Clausewitzian dictums teach us that politics governs war. And to launch a war against Saddam Hussein that is technically efficient solves the problem of whatever resistance the Iraqi army might put up and gets rid of Saddam Hussein. Is you're really only part of the way down the track toward any kind of solution of Iraq, let alone how that war might spill over to our vulnerable conservative Arab allies like Jordan and Saudi Arabia, the oil problem. I noticed President Bush has quietly been building up an enormous inventory of oil, because he knows that if we go to war against Iraq, Saudi Arabia won't pump more oil to keep markets steady. So all of these questions are integral to the question of whether to go to war against Iraq, but the issue is settled in terms of, can we defeat the Iraqi army? Well, we certainly can.
Kurt, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, no, I think that basically this is the right analysis, although I think it's also important to add, the debate so far has started at this kind of level of what should we do militarily. And if the military is not enthusiastic about getting involved all the way in Iraq, they are the least enthusiastic about getting involved halfway. So they, I think, tend to either want to be in front and to defeat the military forces of Iraq quickly and efficiently, or they want to have relatively little to do with it. And so I think that is somewhat has closed off this debate about are there intermediate solutions. But I think it's also important to remember there are other solutions as well. Solutions may be too ambitious a term, but there's still important things to think about in terms of, are there other diplomatic efforts? Are there other ways to think about isolating Iraq further? A difficult prospect at best, as Bruce has pointed out.
Let's take another call. Go ahead, Bruce.
No, please, go ahead and take another call.
Okay, let's talk with Nino. Hello, Nino, you're on Odyssey.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Hello.
I just wanted to call and respond to Kirk's comments about what the American public is interested in. And as you had said earlier, Kirk, that you are shocked when people disagree with you. I guess my purpose today is to shock you once again.
Great.
And And I guess I find it somewhat troubling, the idea that the American public only know economics. And I come from a middle working class family, and over dinner, we have discussions about, I myself am a college student, but nonetheless, we have discussions. My parents, who are only educated so far as high school and have worked their whole lives in the U.S. economy, and we have conversations about the social implications of war, and they understand that. We have conversations about the cultural implications of war, and they understand that. And ultimately, they understand human suffering. The people understand it. However, that element is not brought into the public debate.
Kurt, do you want to respond?
Yeah, Nino, I think that your point is absolutely well taken. And there are of course people who are interested in following this quite closely, but I think that my statement really reflects just what we know about how many people respond to international relations as an issue. Of course, when we're talking about especially the level of should the United States get involved in a war. People have an intense interest in how is that going to affect us? How is it going to work out in the international system? Is it going to make things better or worse? Is it going to affect our families and our economy? But I speak really more just empirically, that we know that in general, people don't pay that much attention to international relations, have relatively little knowledge to base their decisions on. They do so. What they want is they want an informed discussion that they can connect into, and I think that's important to recognize that's the way it works. That's not to say that there are not a lot of people at all levels of society who have intense interests, are focused, and think about international relations on a regular basis, and that's a great thing about the public discussion when it does get going.
John Mearsheimer, did you have a comment?
No, I have nothing to say.
All right, we'll take another call. Let's talk with Dima. Hello, Dima, you're on Odyssey.
Yes. My question is, if you guys can comment, how would a war against Iraq, affect the Islamic world from Morocco to Indonesia? And the second point is, how would a preemptive war, strike a balance in international order? You know, any nation can go to war against a sovereign nation based on the threat it perceives, and how would that affect?
All right, John Mearsheimer?
Well, I think with regard to the Arab and Islamic world, there's almost no question that even if we won the war quickly and decisively and got rid of Saddam Hussein with great ease, that it would engender great animosity towards the United States. The Arab and Islamic world is furious with us because of our policy in the Arab-Israeli conflict, and they're also furious with us because of the sanctions that we've had on Iraq since 1991. And because of the presence of American forces in northern Saudi Arabia. So if we go in and beat up on another Arab country, even if it's Saddam Hussein, I think it's going to cause us all sorts of problems in the Arab and Islamic world, and it's going to complicate the war on terrorism. Furthermore...
Wait, can I stop you there? Because I just want you to clarify. When you say the Arab and Islamic world, do you mean governments there, the public there, everybody there?
By and large, the publics.
Okay.
Many of the governments in the region we have in our back pocket, and this was the second point I was going to make. If you look at the Jordanians, the Egyptians, and the Saudis, their great fear is that from down below there will be an uprising, that the people in the street, the Arab street, so to speak, will rise up if the United States attacks Iraq and topple their regimes, right? We're greatly fearful, given that Jordan has a majority Palestinian population, that if we attack Iraq and Iraq attacks Israel and Israel retaliates, that it could end up toppling the Jordanian regime, which is our friend and does much of our bidding in the Middle East. The same thing is true with the Saudis and the Egyptians. So we have to be very careful that we don't do something that topples these regimes, as well as angers great numbers of people in the Arab and Islamic world and makes them more willing to support terrorism and not willing to work with us to counter terrorists and to get Al-Qaeda in particular.
And you had a second point?
No, that was my second point.
Sorry.
Was about the
particular. I have a second point
okay,
in response
Bruce Cummings.
To the caller's second point, which I think was also a very good one.
About preemptive war.
Yeah, what are we doing, launching wars in the name of non-proliferation? We nearly did that in 1994 with North Korea. A war was just narrowly avoided. And if a war had happened, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people would have died, and the war would have taken 6 months, and it's not clear what the outcome would have been. In the current situation, under international law, there is no right of preemptive attack based on fairly vague ideas that someone is going to acquire nuclear weapons. Furthermore, it's the nuclear weapons powers, preeminently the United States, that launched this doctrine after the Cold War that you can use or threaten force in the interests of non-proliferation. What it tends to do is greatly heighten the already high value of having nuclear weapons as a deterrent for countries like North Korea or Iraq. And in the Middle East, again, you have a quite amazing situation where for decades Israel has been the only regional power with nuclear weapons, and one Arab state after another has tried, or you know, Iran too, has tried to find a way to counter that Israeli deterrent. And it struck me 20 years ago when Israel used the most direct form of non-proliferation activity that you can, when it bombed Saddam Hussein's nuclear reactor and wiped it out. My thought was, well, what if everybody did that? And we tend to go further and further in justifying preemption, using force for non-proliferation, violations of traditional notions of sovereignty, simply because we believe we're right. But there will come a time when the use of these methods redounds to our disadvantage.
Bruce Cummings is a historian at the University of Chicago. He's the author of War and Television, and he joined us today from Ann Arbor, Michigan. We were also joined from Norfolk, Virginia by Kurt Taylor Gaubatz. He's the director of the graduate program in international studies at Old Dominion University and the author of Elections and War. Here in Chicago, John Mearsheimer, political scientist at the University of Chicago and the author most recently of The Tragedy of Great Powers. John Mearsheimer, just briefly, given what's gone on in the last week or so with the leaks and the Biden hearings, do you see the discussion moving in a more debate-oriented direction?
For sure. I think up to this point, the hawks have dominated the debate, and the critics of an attack have been largely silenced. But I think now, and as time goes by, this will change, and the critics will become more and more vocal.
John Mearsheimer, Bruce Cummings, Kurt Taylor Gaubatz, thank you all very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks also to everyone for listening and for calling. Odyssey's theme music was composed and performed by OK Go. Thanks to our research assistant, Allison Rinnick. Our technical producer is Steve Waranowskis. Our show is produced by Allison Cuddy and Delia Lloyd. The senior producer of Odyssey is Joshua Andrews. Odyssey is a production of Chicago Public Radio under general manager Tori Malatia. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Join us again next time for Odyssey.
Odyssey is marketed and distributed by Marge Ostruschko. Funding for the program is provided by generous grants from Doris Sasser, the Staines family, and the listeners of WBEZ Chicago, where Odyssey is produced. The views expressed are not necessarily those of Chicago Public Radio, this station, or its sponsors. To listen again, visit our website, chicagopublicradio.org/odyssey. You can find information there on how to order a copy of the show. That's chicagopublicradio.org/odyssey.